Now, to introduce our study this evening, we'll call forward Brother Lance Pitt to read to us Daniel chapter 4. Thanks for that reading, Brother Lance. I'll now invite your careful attention to Brother Grant as he speaks to us on the subject of Daniel chapter 4.
Well, thanks, Brother James, and good evening, brothers and sisters and young people. We come to yet another exciting chapter in the book of Daniel, another chapter that's filled with practical exhortation and words of prophetic import. Before we get into chapter 4, I'd like to spend just a couple of minutes going back to chapter 2 and dealing with a question that was asked of me with respect to chapter 2. And that was that we didn't really say anything about where Gog fits into the image of that we see in Nebuchadnezzar's vision. And the answer is quite simple, but it's important that we catch hold of that because it really is a key to understanding what we expect to see in the future. So what we've got on the slide here is just two quotes, both of them taken from Elpis Israel, and they really bring to a focus the answer to the question that was asked. Where does Gog fit into the image? The simple answer is that Gog is represented by the image as a whole. Whoops. Try that again. So Gog in the latter days is represented by the image as a whole. Now, just to point that out, I've highlighted a few key words on the slide there, and I'd just like to read those to you. Brother Thomas says, in Elpis Israel, where are the dominions represented by the gold, the silver, the brass and the iron? How can they be broken to pieces together, seeing that they have been broken to pieces one after another very many centuries ago? There will be, in the latter days, a dominion ruling over the countries mainly comprehended in the limits of the successive empires of Babylon, Persia, Greece and Rome, and represented by the image as a whole. The future movements of Russia are notable signs of the times because they are predicted in the scriptures of truth. The Russian autocracy, in its plenitude and on the verge of dissolution, is the image of Nebuchadnezzar standing upon the mountains of Israel, ready to be smitten by the stone. And perhaps you have no need to read further. So that is the answer to the question, that Gog is represented by the image as a whole. All right, Daniel chapter 4. At least 30 years had expired since the events of chapter 3. And during that time, four more waves of captives had arrived at Kibar. And those captives were now what they were always meant to be, strangers and pilgrims. And through the gates of Babylon over a period of 12 years arrived three kings of Judah, Jehoiakim, Jehoiachin, and finally Zedekiah. The last of them, Zedekiah, was brought through the gates of Babylon, led by the hand. His face covered in grief, for there were now just holes where his eyes used to be. Zedekiah was not permitted to be with the other Jews. Instead, he was led to a prison where he remained until the day of his death. As the new captives arrived, so too did the accounts of what had taken place in Judah. Accounts of how Nebuchadnezzar's soldiers had taken no pity. They had mercilessly killed both young and old. But not only so, but their glorious temple, the place where Yahweh had chosen to put his name, had been burned to the ground. And so too the palaces of the kings and nobles. The walls of Jerusalem had been broken down, and only the poor of the people remained. So were fulfilled the words of Jeremiah, Israel is a scattered sheep. The lions have driven him away. First, the king of Assyria hath devoured him. And last, this Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, hath broken his bones. The kingdom of Judah had come to an end. And Nebuchadnezzar stood proudly as the supreme ruler over Egypt, Palestine, Syria, and Mesopotamia. So what was the point of it all? Why did God allow that to happen to his people? Well, as Jeremiah said to Judah, that Judah was sent into the land of the Chaldeans for their good, that they might be caused to return to their God and subsequently to be returned to their land. You see, brothers and sisters and young people, God wanted to do with Judah what he did with Manasseh. Manasseh was perhaps one of the most wicked kings of Judah. And for that reason, God sent his enemies against him, bound him with fetters, took him to Babylon. And in Babylon, he repented and changed his ways and prayed to God, and he was entreated of him. And God took Manasseh from Babylon back to Jerusalem. And so Manasseh became like a model, if you like. He became a witness of what God was prepared to do with Judah, despite their wickedness, if they were prepared to repent as Manasseh had done. God allowed Judah to be taken captive into Babylon with the intent of causing them to repent as Manasseh had. But despite the letters that Jeremiah sent to the Jews in captivity, most of them had now lost all of their desire to return to their homeland and to their God. And they had assimilated into Babylonian culture and beliefs. So what was God going to do to cause them to return to him? Well, that was a work that was going to involve Nebuchadnezzar himself. And so until now, in the first three chapters of Daniel, Daniel and his three friends have featured largely in the book. But when we come to chapter 4, the spotlight shifts and now focuses on the king himself. You'll recall that in the first class we pointed out that the first six chapters, all of them include some sort of encounter with the king, and hence we gave titles to the chapters that reflected that. Chapter 1, standing before the king. Chapter 2, prophesying before the king. Defiance before the king. Counseling before the king. Giving sentence before the king. Deliverance before the king. So all of the chapters, all of the first six chapters, have some sort of encounter with the king. But especially now, chapter 4, the light focuses on Nebuchadnezzar. You see, God was working to turn Judah back to him, and he was going to use Nebuchadnezzar to do that. How? By provoking them to jealousy by a Gentile king who was converted. And perhaps we could bring to bear the words of the Apostle Paul where he said, "Through the Jews' fall, salvation is come to the Gentiles, for to provoke them to jealousy." And that is really key, brothers and sisters and young people, to understanding chapter 4. God was working through Nebuchadnezzar to reform him for his own sake, but also for his people's sake. So God was not just simply seeking from Nebuchadnezzar a confession, but he was seeking a conversion. If you were a Jew, a captive in Babylon, what would your estimation of Nebuchadnezzar be? The one who had mercilessly killed your family. He would be at the top of the most hated list, but at the bottom of the list of those deserving grace. So if in their estimation he was at the bottom of the pack, how would they feel when they saw that God had shown favour to Nebuchadnezzar? What would they think when they saw the greatest advocate of Babylonian religion turning his back on it and rejecting it? What would that say about themselves? If nothing else, it would show them that God was still at work. He was at work right in the very centre of Babylon in the palace. After Nebuchadnezzar was humbled and converted, he said in verse 29, "I make a decree that every people, nation and language which speak anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made a dunghill." And that decree applied to the Jews as well as the Gentiles. How would you feel as a Jew when you read that decree? Perhaps you were one of the Jews that Jeremiah said, when they were taken into captivity, they had profaned the name of Yahweh. And now you're reading a decree from a Gentile king which says, anyone who speaks amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, I'm going to deal with him. I think it would have caused them, brothers and sisters and young people, to reflect upon their own faith. So what happened in the life of Nebuchadnezzar during the last 30 years since chapter 3 took place? Well, Nebuchadnezzar had witnessed two significant miracles. He had witnessed the interpreting of the dream in chapter 2 and the unforgettable experience of seeing three men survive a raging furnace. Yet despite all of that, Nebuchadnezzar was still a very proud man. You see, he had been immensely successful militarily. His civil engineering projects had transformed Babylon into a highly functional, attractive and fortified city. And Herodotus, a Greek historian, wrote, "In addition to its size, Babylon surpasses in splendour any city in the known world." And Herodotus said that the outer walls of Jerusalem were 90 kilometres in length, 24 metres thick, wide enough for two 4-horse chariots to pass by. And one historian wrote, "For extent of dominion, great revenues it supplied, and unrivalled success in war, and the magnificence and splendour of Nebuchadnezzar's court, as well as the stupendous building projects and improvements in the city of Babylon, constituted Nebuchadnezzar incomparably the greatest monarch on a pagan throne the world has ever seen." That was Nebuchadnezzar. So his pride led to stubbornness. And even the godly example of Daniel was not enough to cause this man to change. And his heart was hardened to his own hurt. And you know, we can all be like that at times, can't we? We know there are things in our life that we need to change, and we just won't do it. We know some of the changes that we need to make, but we're like Nebuchadnezzar, we are stiff-necked. And you know, brothers and sisters and young people, often it's to our own hurt that we do that, and it was going to be to Nebuchadnezzar's hurt. What would it take? What would it take to turn this man, to change him? He had witnessed things that no other man had seen, of three men thrown into a fire, and it still wasn't enough to change him. What was needed was something to touch him personally, something to touch him that would cause him to change his life. You know, I'm sure that Daniel would have prayed about this often. prayed for Nebuchadnezzar to see the sun and to understand the greater purpose that there is in life. And perhaps he thought the words of Ecclesiastes 3 verse 18, I said in mine heart concerning the estates of the Son of Man, that God might manifest them and that they might see themselves are beasts. Nebuchadnezzar indeed was to see that he was a beast. And more importantly, that his dominion had been set up by God and not by himself. And that's the story of chapter 4. We might break up chapter 4 this way. I mean, it can be broken up a number of ways, but it contains at least these key sections. The king's proclamation, the king's recollection of the dream, Daniel's interpretation of the dream, the king's fulfillment of the dream, and the king's praise of the God of heaven. Well, those first few verses, those first three verses of chapter 4, are really, a prologue to the declaration that he makes at the end of the chapter. But just for now, brothers and sisters and young people, what we want to do is just pick out one or two points from those first three verses that give us an insight into the development of Nebuchadnezzar's understanding. Let's just reflect for a moment, pause and reflect. In chapter 2, at the end of chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar declared this, that Daniel's God was a revealer of secrets. In other words, he acknowledged that Daniel's God was omniscient, all-knowing. At the end of chapter 3, Nebuchadnezzar declared that there is no God that can deliver like the God of Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego. He saw Daniel's God, or the God of Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, as like a patron saint, someone who is a guardian over his servants. In chapter 4, there's a change. He now confesses what he hadn't previously, and that is, as he says at the end of verse 3, that Yahweh's dominion is both now and forever. In other words, even his kingdom was in the hand of God. But notice also that previously he had referred in chapters 2 and 3 to the God of Daniel, or the God of Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego. But now he refers to the high God, or, as later in the chapter, to the God of heaven. So in verses 4 to 18, we have the king's recollection of the dream. In verse 5, Nebuchadnezzar reveals that he had a second dream. And when we read through it, it's almost a replay of chapter 2. He receives a dream, verse 5, that made him afraid. In verse 6, he called the wise men to make known the interpretation. In verse 7, he calls first the magicians, the astrologers, the Chaldeans and the soothsayers. And once again, they could not make known the dream. Verse 8, at last, Daniel is called and is able to interpret the dream. But there is one important difference this time compared to chapter 2. This time he could remember the dream and didn't require the wise men to tell him what the dream was. You see, I think there's a reason for that. Nebuchadnezzar sensed that this dream was an ill omen. The parallels between the first vision and the second were unmistakable. An image being smashed and a tree being felled violently. If an image being smashed foretold the demise of his kingdom, what calamity would the cutting down of a tree and a man being made like a beast mean for him personally? There was a certain foreboding about the vision. He could sense that there were dark clouds ahead. And so he sought, therefore, first to the wise men, in the hope that their horoscope might be a good news story. And this time, he gave them a bit of a leg up by not requiring them to reveal the vision as he did in chapter 2. But as we know, his plan is thwarted. The wise men are powerless to provide an explanation. And yet again, the gods of Babylon fail him. And at last, Daniel is called. Notice what he says in verse 9 to Daniel. O Belteshazzar, master of the magicians, because I know that the spirit of the holy gods is in thee, and no secret troubleth thee, tell me the visions of my dream that I have seen and the interpretation thereof. Notice the confidence that Nebuchadnezzar has in the ability of Daniel to interpret the dream. And when you think about it, that confidence discredits his decision to approach the wise men at all. He knew that if he went to Daniel, he was going to get the truth. But he didn't want the truth. This was a report card that he didn't want to open. So in verses 10 to 17, Nebuchadnezzar proceeds to outline the dream to Daniel. It goes something like this. There are really five parts to it. The domination of a tree, the destruction of the tree, the banding of the stump, the bestiality of the man, and the decree of the watchers. When Daniel heard of the felling of the tree, he would have thought of Ezekiel 31. Ezekiel 31 contains very similar language that's used to describe Assyria as a cedar in Lebanon. And there the cutting down of the tree foretold the end of the Assyrian dynasty, which had come to pass. And having made known the dream to Daniel, he calls upon him in verse 18 to make known the interpretation. And what transpires, brothers and sisters and young people, gives us what I think is a wonderful insight into the relationship that had developed between these two men, the king and Daniel. They had been together for over 30 years. We're told in verse 19, let's just read that together. Then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was astonished for 1 hour, and his thoughts troubled him. The king spake and said, Belteshazzar, let not the dream or the interpretation thereof trouble thee. And Belteshazzar answered and said, my lord, the dream be to them that hate thee, and the interpretation thereof to thine enemies. Daniel was numb. He was unable to speak. His thoughts troubled him, and he was clearly very distressed by what was about to happen to the king whom he addresses as my lord. You notice that? He addresses him as my lord twice in verse 19 and 24. And conversely, the king, seeing the anguish on Daniel's face, says, Belteshazzar, let not the dream trouble thee. From what we're told of Nebuchadnezzar, it seems incongruous, doesn't it, that Daniel could show any feeling towards this man, a man who had not only destroyed God's people, but had also desecrated his temple. But clearly, Daniel saw in Nebuchadnezzar attributes that are not revealed to us. You see, for 30 years, the king had had regular contact with a man that was greatly beloved of God. In Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar saw qualities not found in the magicians, the astrologers, and the soothsayers. In Daniel, he saw humility. He saw loyalty, mercy, truth, and justice. And the question for us is, what effect do we have on people? What effect do we have on people so far as shaping their lives for eternity is concerned? You know, we can be good company for each other, brothers and sisters and young people. We can be enjoyable to talk to. We can be chatty. We can keep the conversation going. But what effect do we have on each other so far as shaping one another for the kingdom? Are we ambassadors for Christ? When people at work see us, do they see Christ? Do we inspire people by our way of life, our consistency, our dedication? Is there consistency between our mouth and our feet? And do we entice people to ask us about what makes you tick? What do you do on weekends? How do you spend your time? So Daniel composes himself and expresses his desire that the dream might apply to Nebuchadnezzar's enemies. The dream was foretold in a figure that Nebuchadnezzar's reign was to be interrupted by a period of madness, during which he would dwell with the beasts of the field. And the man who had risen to the loftiest of heights was to experience the basest of human experiences. Verse 22. It is thou, O king, that art grown and become strong, for thy greatness is grown and reacheth unto heaven, and thy dominion to the end of the earth. Nebuchadnezzar, you are the tree. The height and the strength of the tree symbolized the strength and extent of his dominion. And the tree provided food and shelter for fowls and beasts. And we know, don't we, from Daniel 7 and 8, that animals are used to represent nations. And in this case, the nations that are under Nebuchadnezzar's dominion are represented by the tree providing shelter and food. And the tree reached up unto heaven, an expression which is interpreted in Isaiah 14 to mean he exalted himself to divine status. Yet he would be driven from men and would dwell with and behave like a beast for a period of seven times, which we understand to be a period of 7 years. But the tree which represented Nebuchadnezzar's dominion was not to be uprooted. The stump was to be preserved by a band of iron and brass. A single band of iron and brass was there to preserve the stump, signifying that his sovereignty was to be regained after 7 years, but subject to Nebuchadnezzar repenting and acknowledging that God ruled in the kingdom of men. In other words, his sovereignty was not by his own achievement, but by God's appointment. And it appears, doesn't it, that even though Nebuchadnezzar dwelt with the beast for those 7 years, that he still had sufficient presence of mind to know where to look and where to turn to for help. Because at the end of that time, we're told that he lifted up his eyes to heaven and turned to God. What was the purpose of the dream? Well, I think there's a couple of key reasons. You think about it. God could have just not given Nebuchadnezzar the dream. He could have just sent him out to dwell amongst the beasts without the dream being given. God deliberately foretold through the vision what would happen, so that when it did happen, both he and all his house would know with a surety that what had taken place was from God. And for the same reason, he was told that this matter is by the decree of the Holy Ones. In other words, Nebuchadnezzar, that the events that are about to befall you were not random, but they were by divine appointment, not by chance. And just commenting on verse 17, where we read, "This matter is by the decree of the watchers." The watchers, of course, being a term used to describe the role of the angels, or in this particular context, the angels communing with one another and deciding between themselves as to what they were going, or what was to be done with Nebuchadnezzar. And they reach a decision, and the decree goes forth. And an ancient historian that wrote of this period, he uses these words to describe that, what he calls tribunal in the heaven. And I think it's really good the way he words it. He says, "This tribunal of the angels, which is forever assembled, though invisible to mortal eyes, pronounced the like sentence on those famous conquerors, on those heroes of the pagan world who, like Nebuchadnezzar, considered themselves as the sole authors of their exalted fortune." That's Roland, volume 1, page 18. But there's another reason, I believe, why the dream was given. You see, the dream helped Nebuchadnezzar to believe that the Most High indeed ruleth in the kingdom of men. And the fact that God had the power to dethrone him was proof that God had the power to enthrone him. And you know, the implications of that for Nebuchadnezzar were massive. You see, to believe that the God of Daniel controlled both national and human affairs turned upside down Nebuchadnezzar's concept of religion, his identity, and his self-determination. But apart from acknowledging the omnipotence of God, there was a far more important objective that God had in mind. Note verse 27, if we just turn over the page, where Daniel, having given an interpretation of the dream, gives these words of counsel. "Wherefore, O king, let my counsel be accepted unto thee, and break off thy sins by righteousness, and thine iniquities by showing mercy to the poor, if it may be a lengthening of thy tranquility." You see, the kingdom was taken from Nebuchadnezzar for moral reasons, and God was seeking more than an acknowledgement from Nebuchadnezzar. He was seeking repentance. Break off your sins, Nebuchadnezzar. God was seeking a moral transformation, and it took 7 years. So, God held a pagan king accountable for his morality. Was that just? Yes, it was. Why? Because, you see, he had witnessed evidence of the existence of a supreme being. In short, knowledge brings accountability. And God's condemnation of Belshazzar, his grandson, in Daniel 5, verse 22, let's just turn over the page, or two pages, Daniel 5, verse 22. He's just told Belshazzar in his palace that, "Belshazzar, you've known all about your grandfather, how he was lifted up in pride and what God did to him." And verse 22, "And thou, his son, O Belshazzar, hast not humbled thine heart, though thou knewest all this." If God reveals himself to someone, he expects a humble response. And he didn't get it from Nebuchadnezzar when he should have. No one does that to God. No one does that to God and gets away with it. Why? What attribute of God is the reason why that is the case? What do we call that attribute of God that makes a person accountable when they come to know God? It's called His Majesty. You know, we're accustomed to thinking that a young person becomes accountable when they're baptized. That's true. They do become accountable when they're baptised. But let's never think, brothers and sisters and young people, that there is no accountability or responsibility, perhaps is a better word. There is no responsibility until a person is baptised. To the extent that we know what God expects, He holds us responsible. We know the story. We know that Nebuchadnezzar didn't heed the words of Daniel. In his mercy, God gave Nebuchadnezzar 12 months to repent. And in Nebuchadnezzar's own words, he walked in pride and his mind hardened in pride. And the veracity of those words is indelibly inscribed on numerous clay tablets of the period. Have a look at this. I constructed inside Babylon on the eastern side of the river a fortification such as no king had ever made before me. I excavated the ditch. With brick and mortar I bound its bed, a long rampart at its head I strongly built. I adorned its gates, the folding doors and the pillars, I plated with copper. Against presumptuous enemies who were hostile to the men of Babylon, great waters, like the waters of the ocean, I made use of abundantly. Thus I completely made strong the defences of Babylon. May it last forever. You know, pride compassed Nebuchadnezzar about as a chain, and he couldn't break free from it. But God was going to snap that chain for him. The fateful day came as Nebuchadnezzar was calmly walking in his palace, stroking his ego, speaking about his achievements and his majesty. He heard a voice, not just any voice, a voice from heaven. Verse 30. And the king spake and said, "Is not this great Babylon that I have built for the house of the kingdom by the might of my power and for the honour of my majesty?" And while the word was in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven saying, "O King Nebuchadnezzar, to thee it is spoken, the kingdom is departed from thee. And they shall drive thee from men, and thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and they shall make thee to eat grass, and seven times shall pass over thee, until thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will." You know, the ironic thing about pride is that it ultimately and inevitably will hurt us. The greater the pride, the greater the hurt. We know the sayings, "Pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. When pride cometh, then cometh shame. A man's pride shall bring him low." All these things became the experience of Nebuchadnezzar. He fell. He experienced shame. He was brought low. And more so, his health was injured. And those things follow pride as certain as night follows day. So the same hour he was driven from the palace and for 7 years lived in the wild and ate grass like an ox. His condition is a very rare disease which is called boanthropy, a physiological disorder in which the sufferer believes he or she is a cow or an ox. And little is really known about it because it's so rare. But what we do know is that it makes a person moody. In a sense, God gave him what he wanted. He wanted to obey his animal instincts, so he was given the company of those of like mind. And you know, we read often, don't we, that God gave them up, which is another way of saying God will give us what we want. I gave them up unto their own heart's lusts. God also gave them up to uncleanness through the lust of their own hearts. God gave them up unto vile affections. So be careful. Whatever you desire in your heart, God will give it to you. But just remember this, it's a package deal. We're not told what the effect was on the palace, but you know, we can work it out. Everyone in the palace and the realm would have known not only what happened to Nebuchadnezzar, but also why. The event was a complete embarrassment to the royal family. What do you say when the king is seen eating grass in the botanic gardens? He's become a vegetarian. No, that wouldn't cut it. The palace would have inquired of Daniel about the one who had made the decree and why. And the answer had been given, as we read in chapter 5 and verse 20, that he was lifted up in pride. And the people would learn that not only that the malady was sent from God, but it would be removed by God, subject to the Nebuchadnezzar's repentance. And if you think about it, why was it that he wasn't usurped? Why was it that during that 7-year period that his son or someone else didn't take the throne? Well, I think the reason is because the people were afraid. They believed that God had brought that malady upon him. And if anyone was to usurp his throne in defiance of what God had said would happen, look out. And for that reason, while we're not told what happened in the palace, I think we can conclude that there was a fear of God. When did this occur in Nebuchadnezzar's life? And I'm conscious that time is quickly getting away from us. I believe that it occurred right towards the very end of his life. And I'm going to have to start moving quickly through some of these slides. The dating that's been suggested here, right towards the very end of his life, is supported by two what I would call really credible historians, George Rawlinson and Charles Roland, who wrote those two books. How did they reach that conclusion? Well, you see, in the first part of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, up until about at least 584 BC, he was engaged in campaigns in Syria, in Palestine, in Egypt, and then back again. So that first sort of 20 years of his reign was fully occupied in war. And then there was a period of building. And really the crowning jewel of his construction work was the building of the Ishtar Gate, which was finished in about 575. So really there was only a short window where this could have taken place. Well, so Nebuchadnezzar, we're told, he ruled from 605 to 562. And therefore, when you take all those time periods into account, really there is only a short period at the end. And as Roland says, he believes he died the year following his recovery. So as we read in verse 34, at the end of the times, Nebuchadnezzar turned to God. Verse 34, at the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up mine eyes unto heaven, and my understanding returned to me. Nebuchadnezzar's praise suggests that he had not only been humbled, but he had been converted by the experience. Look at his feelings towards God, verse 34. He blessed, praised, honoured God. Verse 37, he praised, extolled and honoured God. And now Yahweh is no longer just the God of Daniel or Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego. Verse 34, he's the Most High God. Verse 37, he's the King of Heaven. And what about Yahweh's sovereignty? Verse 34, he says, his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom from generation to generation. Verse 35, he doeth according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none, not even me, can stay his hand. And finally, look at Nebuchadnezzar's perspective of himself in verse 35. The inhabitants of the earth, including me, are reputed as nothing. So, in the words of Daniel chapter 7 and verse 4, a man's heart was given to him. And now, Nebuchadnezzar, the ruler, the greatest ruler the world has ever seen in the palace in Babylon, is now a witness to the Jews that their God was the only true and living God, and he's still at work. And so from there, brothers and sisters and young people, Nebuchadnezzar disappears from the record. He's mentioned no more in Daniel. But I don't believe he's forgotten in the eyes of the one that he now worshipped. And I'd like to think that Nebuchadnezzar will be numbered amongst the angelic host that will proclaim, Babylon is fallen, that great city, because she made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. And perhaps there is the suggestion of this based in the prominence of his confession in the structure of the book. You might remember that we saw this in an earlier class, how Nebuchadnezzar's confession is a hinge point in the book. And in the section of Daniel that is written in Syriac, there is a chiastic structure which is hinged on the very confession of Nebuchadnezzar. So is chapter 4 recorded just to tell us about the life of Nebuchadnezzar? I think there is a dual application, brothers and sisters and young people. The chapter wasn't just about the personal experiences of Nebuchadnezzar. And I think the hint of that is the fact that in the vision that was given to him, we were told that the stump was banded with iron and brass. And that had no relevance in Nebuchadnezzar's experience. So the key is in the banding. The key to understanding the secondary application is in the banding of the tree. What does it signify? What does the stump represent? And what is the significance of the banding? Well, let's just read again verse 26. And whereas they commanded to leave the stump of the tree roots, thy kingdom shall be sure unto thee, after that thou shalt have known that the heavens do rule. So you see, the stump represents the kingdom of Babylon, and the single band of iron and brass was there to preserve the stump. We don't have time, but in a book called The Two Babylons, the author Alexander Hislop tells the story about how the religions of Babylon found their way into the Roman Catholic religion. And that is one of the ways in which the Babylonian stump was preserved by the band of iron and brass. But what about the brass? The Roman Catholic Church became a preserver, if you like, of the Babylonian religion. But what about the brass? How was the Babylonian stump preserved by the brass? Well, you might remember when we dealt with chapter 2 that we saw that in 320, Constantine founded a new capital in Greece, which he called Constantinople. In time, the Eastern Empire developed its own brand of Christianity that became known as the Greek Orthodox Church. But in 1054, there was a great schism between the Roman Catholic Church in the West and the Greek Orthodox Church in the East. And furthermore, when Constantine was conquered by the Ottomans, that Greek church migrated from Constantinople to Moscow, and that's a story in itself. But the church didn't disappear. That's the point. It moved to Moscow, and Moscow in a sense became the third Rome. So the point is that the Greek Orthodox Church continued, albeit in a different location. So what are we saying then? The stump represents the kingdom of Babylon, and the band of iron and brass represents the Roman and Greek religions. We note that in two or three places in chapter 4, we're told this important piece of information, that the band was one band. It wasn't two bands, it was one band. And that's really interesting in the light of some recent developments. Have a look at this. In 2016, for the first time since 1054, when the schism occurred, the leaders of the Roman Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church met to talk about what? To talk about reunion. And this is how it was depicted, as the East meets the West. So here we have Pope Francis and Patriarch Kirill meeting in Havana. Isn't that incredible, brothers and sisters? There was one band of iron and brass. Well, what about the seven times? What is the secondary application of the seven times? We've only got a few minutes to go over this, but we can get the essence of it. A time is 360 days in Jewish reckoning. So seven times is 2,520 days. And on the principle of a day for a year, as taught in Ezekiel chapter 4, that corresponds to 2,520 days, 2,520 days. I'm going to take a slight digression, and please allow me to. I want to show you something really interesting that becomes a little tool when you're talking to JWs about their beliefs. And it goes like this. This is a slide taken from a JW's book. And what's the relevance of this to us? Well, you see, in this book, it says that it makes reference to this period that we're talking about in Daniel 4, the 2520 years. Now, the JWs like to say that Christ returned and the kingdom of God was established in 1914. So you have to wind back the clock 2520 years to get the starting point. What's the problem with that? Can anyone see an issue? They're saying that 607 BC was Jerusalem being destroyed. Can anyone see a problem with that? It wasn't destroyed in 607 BC. And this is a good point to pick up with them. And here's the proof, indisputable proof. Nebuchadnezzar was a very organized man. He organized astrologers as well as scribes and other things. Astrologers were people that watched the night sky. They understood about the five planets. They understood about the constellation of stars. And what they did was they recorded the movement of the planets with respect to the stars. And so accurate was their recordings that you can, and as has been done, there's a tablet that was found that recorded one of their observations. It's called the VAT 4956. And the VAT tells us that it was recorded in the 37th year of Nebuchadnezzar. And here's the interesting thing. Because of the consistency in the movements of the stars and the planets, software's been written whereby you can wind the clock back and you can look at a sky as Nebuchadnezzar would have looked at 2,500 years ago. So they wound back the clock to find a time in history that corresponded to the observations made on this clay tablet. And it came up with 568 BC. But here's the crunch. Here's the point that's fatal to the teachings of the JWs. We're told in 2 Kings 25 that Jerusalem was destroyed in the 19th year of Nebuchadnezzar. If you subtract the difference between when the astronomical observation was made and the destruction of Jerusalem, you come up with, guess what, 586 BC. So it's a point of interest that you can talk to the JWs next time they knock on your door. Okay, so what is the relevance of the 2520 years? Well, if you take the commencement from 570 BC which was when Nebuchadnezzar's madness started, and I think there are good grounds for that, you come to 1951. What was significant about 1951, and what's the relevance of it to Daniel's prophecy? Well, something very interesting happened in 1951. In 1951, the foreign ministers of West Germany, France, Italy and the Netherlands, Belgium, Luxembourg, issued a joint statement called the Europe Declaration. And that was signed, the declaration was issued at the signing of the Treaty of Paris. The declaration included the statement, by the signature of this treaty, the involved parties give proof of their determination to create the first supranational institution, and that thus they are, note this, laying the true foundation of an organised Europe. And you say, so what? I'm going to put up this chart, which I know you can't read down the back, so I'm going to tell you what it says. What it's depicting is this, that we know about the European Union today, but what we perhaps don't appreciate is that it was the bringing together of a number of pre-existing arrangements that had been made in Europe. Now, the first of those was this one that took place in 1951. So in 1951, the Treaty of Paris that we've just read about laid the foundation for the formation of the European Union. So what? You remember in the vision that Nebuchadnezzar saw, he said that the tree provided two things. It provided food and it provided protection for all the nations that were under the umbrella of the Babylonian dominion. That's the mantra of the European Union. It's really a Catholic club where the nations that are under that umbrella are working with a common objective to create a framework where they can trade together, provide food for each other, and guess what? They're now talking about providing a common military. That's really the imagery of what we see in Daniel chapter 4. There was an ecosystem created that Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian, sustained. That really brings us to the end, brothers and sisters and young people. Perhaps we can close on this thought. Our closing hymn 87, I think has words that perhaps describe the thoughts that Nebuchadnezzar would have had after he was converted. Verse 3. O'er all nations, God alone, higher than the heavens his throne, who is like to God most high, infinite in majesty? Yea, to view the heavens he bends, yea, to earth he condescends. Passing by the rich and great, for the low and desolate. He can raise the poor to stand with the princes of the land, wealth upon the needy shower, set the meanest high in power.